friends, welcome to episode 257 of Storyteller Conclave. This is a show all about helping you run the best tabletop role-playing game that you can, whether you're a new storyteller or dungeon master learning the craft, or an experienced storyteller looking to take your game to the next level. I'm Sarah.
I'm Rob.
How are we doing, Rob?
You know, it's... I'm going to say it's one of those days where it's like everything is just an eighth of an inch off.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we're good. We have good weather.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have the availability of that we're doing okay. Like, we haven't ran any games recently or done anything like that. So there seems to be like a gap there. But at the same time, like, work is at a weird pace.
Yeah.
Like, I keep having things taken away from me and given back to me at other spaces. So it's just everything feels like a degree off, just ever so slightly.
I got to your place tonight to record, and I just literally almost curled up on your couch and took a 20-minute nap.
You did. You were adorable.
However, you had Dole Whip.
I did.
So that made everything bright and shiny again.
Yes, 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 yes. And I don't want to go too far into, like... I guess kibitzing here because we have people in the wings. We our show tonight is our system spotlight. We are spotlighting a brand new kickstarted, fully funded campaign that was kicked off today.
Yeah.
That is an exciting thing. So with us, to talk about this show. Now, let me say our system spotlight tonight is Eureka, investigative urban fantasy. Now, if you've been in the Discord, you're familiar with these, with some links that got thrown around in there. You've probably heard from Addison Goff, who is captain on our Discord right now. He is the lead writer, lead designer, PR manager, team director, enthusiastically enjoying every moment of talking about this. And has been around the hobby for at least 10 years, is stationed in Louisiana, but doing okay. The weather held out for us, so we're good there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then also is Ash Sanders. She is also part of the ANIM team, that has been working on this. I'm going to say this. Getting to know them just a few days ago and doing our audio checks with them changed the way I looked at this game initially.
It's always fascinating. The few times that we have been able to speak with the minds behind the systems that we're taking a look at, during our past conversation, you had mentioned when we got to speak with the creators of Plane Gia.
Yes,
you know. Was absolutely great.
Yes.
And it's really great being able to pick their brains and see kind of like what some of the thought processes and such like that went into some of the creation of this investigative urban fantasy game is.
So without further ado, let's bring them together with us here. Addison, Ash, are you out there?
Hello.
Yes, we welcome to the table now.
Awesome. Hello, thank you so much for joining us. We are so excited. And I have to say, congratulations on the Kickstarter. Where are we currently at, Addison?
Let me look.
Yeah, I know you said it was well over 100%. I don't know if you broke 200% funding.
Already?
Yeah, I mean...
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
The goal was where it needed to be to be able to hit that, but I am so happy for them where they're at. So.
Is 180%.
That is fantastic to hear. That always feels good.
Yeah.
So, how are you two doing with this Kickstarter today? How are you feeling?
Pretty excited.
Very buzzed.
There has to be a certain sense of like you've made it. You've hit that mark. You know, like, up to this point, it was like, we're designing, we're talking to people, there seems to be some excitement about this, and now you're here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yeah. I guess it feels very real now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I'm hoping that we can hit the stretch goals, because we've got a lot of really cool stretch goals. I had to keep putting a bunch of stuff into stretch goals.
That's a good problem to have.
Like, yeah, once I... At a certain point, I was like, I need to... finish this up, and then anything else if I just have like a random idea that's like that would be really cool but it's not strictly necessary, I was throwing it in stretch goals.
Okay.
Oh yeah, I did see actually in some of the promo material you guys sent us, like in the rule book, it was like, here's a list of things, and it was like Kickstarter, 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 Kickstarter. Yes. So I'm like, oh, these are all stretch goals. I gotcha.
So let's start, I guess, right at the beginning, with this a little bit. What is ANIM, that acronym in the group? It seems like it's some kind of a team. And how did the two of you get pulled into this? Do you want to start, Addison?
I will start. So ANIM stands for the Agency of Narrative Intrigue and Mystery,
ooh,
which is what we decided to call our company.
Okay.
When we formed it in like February of last year or something. And the way I initially got on the team was I was asked by Brandon, and Brandon is the third team member who is not here. That would have been like November 2021.
Okay.
So quite some time. I was asked by Brandon to playtest his new game that he was coming up with, and playtesting turned into writing because I was like reading it, and I was like, this seems like the kind of thing where there would be an occasional fight, and Brandon, you have no combat system in this game.
Okay.
And so I wrote one, and then I was on the team.
You started your own problem.
Yeah. Brandon, I think, initially came up with this idea because he wanted like better ways to run Call of Cthulhu and Trail of Cthulhu.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. He wasn't really satisfied with the investigation in those systems.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And once I joined the team, I also, and like once I started to be like a rules writer on it, I also wanted to take like investigation gameplay rules in another, you know, like a direction that I had not seen before. And without making it like ridiculously granular.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Ash, how did you then think it pulled into all this?
Yeah. So I actually came pretty late to the party. I joined the book club, which was something that got set up in late 23, like November of 23,
mm-hmm.
To play, you know, different indie TTRPGs, but it was run by Anim. And I got involved in that community. And
we still do that, by the way.
We still do that. Started talking to Addison there, and started to just contribute here and there to various projects. I did, I think, I don't remember exactly when it started, but sometime a couple months after that, I actually was asked to help him like edit the supernatural section, like the monster section.
Mm-hmm.
He just had a really good workflow, and also realized how badly the book needed an editor. So decided to bring me onto the team to help out with that and get the whole thing, you know, polished.
Okay, so that being said, I have to ask the question. When we were going through the, I'll say the drafts that we got, there were some references to legacy versions. How long has this actually kind of as a culmination been in development?
I don't remember when Brandon started it. He would have started it. I don't know. He could have started it maybe as early as 2016.
Okay.
But it really started taking off when, it had a pretty big leap forward in when I started writing for it in like December-ish of 2021 and January 2022. But then it really, really got off the ground. I think it really got off the ground in, really got off the ground in like January.
Okay.
Of 2023, because that's when I started to like really, really, really pound away at it and start doing like working on it like 3 to 9 hours a day every day or every weekday at least.
Oh wow, yeah, that's
because I was for the past like 3 years, I've been in and out of some pretty bad jobs, and I've got a pretty good job right now, which is part time, but it's not going to be a job I can have forever. There's limited work for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I need something, and decided to try and push for a career in this, something I enjoy and something I think I'm good at.
Yeah. I mean, why not do the thing that you love?
Yeah. January 2023, the first like public demo version of the game was September 2023, I think.
Okay.
That's when
okay.
Public with it.
All right. Now, there's a lot of feeling about this game as far as that we were getting. Like, Sarah and I always take a look at things and see, like, does this feel like a more narrative game? Does this feel like a more, you know, simulationist game? And there was definitely some Powered by the Apocalypse vibes that were going on here, but you make it pretty clear that this is not Powered by the Apocalypse.
Yeah.
So what were some of the inspirations? Like, what's the definitioning that you kind of polished into this?
Well, first, I'd probably say that all games are narrative games, but I shouldn't go off on a tangent on that.
Fair enough.
Not every game tells the same narrative that a movie would tell, but let's see.
So did you take any inspiration from some games? You talked about Call of Cthulhu directly.
Yeah. Well, all right. So the deal with... I don't personally like a lot of what Powered by the Apocalypse does.
Okay. Fair enough.
And how it does it. But I think that Eureka is kind of aiming for the same destination. I just don't like how it gets there. And Eureka is... The plan is for Eureka to get to that destination with a different, through a different route.
Okay. Versus taking the Powered by the Apocalypse scenic stroll through things. You know, you guys seem to have a much more direct path, specifically with investigation and the way you guys focus on that. I mean, even so much as to say, like, Powered by the Apocalypse, for the most part, the games don't feel like they have a combat system in the general sense of them. Whereas this,
right.
Clearly you designed a heavy one, and I quote by saying this, the combat in Eureka system is exceptionally dangerous and realistically compared to many other TTRPG systems. Okay, so what was the motivation for that? You said it was needed. Where does that come from?
Yes, it is. I think it is needed to have I think it's deadly to have I think it is important that Eureka have a deadly combat system.
Mm-hmm.
Because having combat be dangerous and deadly is something that having combat be dangerous and deadly is something that somewhat discourages it and encourages investigators to investigate instead. Only fighting when they have to or when they know they'll have the upper hand.
Right.
And then if you have it be deadly, it has to be deep. It can't be deadly and then not deep, because if it's deadly and it's not deep, then it's just not fun, because then there's very little agency or strategy to the combat.
Right. You need to be able to kind of know what your options are and be able to exercise those options to be able to engage
just
with
deadly,
it.
But then simple. Then
right. Nobody wants it. Like combat like, rolled out, and somebody got the drop on you, and they just one shot you. Congratulations, that was combat, and you're dead. Yeah. You know,
and right. It doesn't have any meaning either when you just wipe out a bunch of guys.
Right.
So this encourages not only for like more violent options to be something that might be considered, but not something that is the go-to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it also makes it so that even when it is time for combat and when combat is inevitable, it still encourages investigation, because investigation will, as particularly if it's some, if the bad guy is some kind of monster with a particular weakness, investigation will give the investigators an edge in combat. By being able to form a plan.
Rewarding and, preparation, yeah.
Right, rewarding preparation, well, study, which does not really happen in a like overly simplified combat system.
Knox in the Box in our live chat says, be a bit more balanced Dick Tracy investigator and less a fighty-fighty Batman.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
No, I think that the combat system I kind of found fascinating because it is very rooted in sort of a simulationist, very realistic, like, guns are deadly. Like, one... I love that, like, bullet was just listed as, like, the max tier damage. Mm-hmm. And right. You don't even get into the nitty-gritty of, like, is it a 38 special? Is it a 30-06? I don't care. It is a bullet, and you are a squishy water balloon.
Yeah.
You know, filled with blood, so...
Bad things happen.
Bad things happen. And I think that kind of pervades, that sort of same feel pervades the rest of the game in that it is very down to earth. It's very realistic. You treat people like people, like human mm-hmm. beings, and you kind of take on that sort of gritty realism outlook there. It was described as being contemporary and noir, and the phrase, "What would a person do?" is used right. frequently throughout the book. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So there's a term that you used when we were doing the audio checks earlier, which was like the metal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the metal is, as I understand it, maybe if you would maybe describe that quickly, like define that term.
Finding the metal in something is actually something we got from when we talked to Mr. Summerton from the Plain Gia. System and that was essentially the thing that differentiates and pushes, you know, cranks your game up to 11, you know.
Yeah,
that core of something that you look at and you go, okay, that's badass.
Yeah,
that's the thing I want to engage with.
What am I doing with this rule? What am I doing with this discipline within the game, this mechanic or whatever? How can I make this more metal? Like, how can I bind it with the rest of this game and make it feel complete?
Yeah.
And I would say that when we were talking, that concept kind of came out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just listened to the Planet Gia episode recently, and yeah, it makes sense to me. The metal of Eureka, the through line, is absolutely, you know, verisimilitude in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to encourage organic decision-making so that when you have the question, you know, what is the investigator doing? In any given scenario, it's likely to be the same thing that a real person would do if they were put into a similar situation. If an investigator is facing up against a scary monster, the mechanics are going to encourage them to see running away as an appealing option.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think that we as a team are, you know, opinionated about realism necessarily being a better design choice than stylization. We have a lot of pretty crazy stuff on the back burner. We can talk about that another day.
You might hear about that later.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a... I do think that realism is a design choice that suits what Eureka is doing better. It's in line with that metal, right?
Right, right. Absolutely. So let's actually kind of dive into a little bit about some of like the core rules, some of the dice mechanics and whatnot, what kind of under the hood as a system makes Eureka tick. So the reason I think we started off by kind of comparing it to Powered by the Apocalypse is because your dice system is actually this, it's just the dice system. There's no moves necessarily like Powered by the Apocalypse has, but the 2d6 resolution where 7 to 9 is a partial success, 10 plus is a full success, and 6 and under is a failure, is your core dice mechanic.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that 10 or more has no extra value. It's not like you critically succeed or, you know, whether you have 30 as your final result does not matter.
Right,
You succeeded. That's it.
You say the investigator succeeded in Eureka.
Correct. And one of the, one of the things that we talked about, especially in the pre-check as we were going through things, is that there's a specific mechanic that everything kind of wraps around. and that is this concept of and design of composure. This selfness, or this almost like, image of personal self of how you are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes back to that, like, what would a human do? Well, what would a human do once they are not doing well, you know, themselves? And it's emotional damage. It caps your base modifier. So no matter what, you could be great at firearms, but if your composure is a one, your firearms is a one.
Right.
Like, you're shaking to take that shot. It's not like you can push past it. And one of the things that you came back to, and you described this actually in our Discord, and I know some people got very interested in it, was that you promoted the concept of downtime for your investigators, that this is something that they need, these little moments to regain their composure, so that they can continue being at the peak that they can be at. What I want to kind of get into is how do you feel that plays into the mood? I know we talked about it a little bit, but it does feel like it's the mechanic that makes or breaks the moment within the game. I'm not too sure which one of you want to hit that one.
I kind of threw it at you a little.
Which one
of us was going to take this one?
It's all right. I can start here anyway. But yeah, I do think that composure plays into just about everything that Eureka is doing. It like you said, it caps the skills of the investigators. It is something where, you know, almost any trait that plays with the mechanics is going to have some relationship to composure, whether it be adding a bonus that isn't capped by composure, or whether it be giving another means to restore it, or to restore it more efficiently, or capping the ways that it can be, you know, restricting the ways that it can be regained. Everything plays into this mechanic. It represents, not just like mental stress, but also physical needs to some extent. Like, composure is also representing if someone is just doesn't have enough sleep. You know, if they stay up all night on a stakeout, mm-hmm. and they're just shaking, needing sleep, or if a monster hasn't, like if a vampire hasn't taken blood in, hasn't gone hunting, low composure also represents that. So it basically represents the current status of an investigator. I would say just as much as their physical wounds, and if it gets low enough, it can start dipping into that too.
Yeah, you have the health tracks that are in the game.
Mm-hmm.
These two different health tracks that kind of speak to both the light and physical, as well as an injury scale that can go on top of that can affect somebody permanently. But this composure aspect, I think, plays into another component that's within the mechanic that I think is kind of key as a mechanic, but doesn't necessarily sit at the same level as what we normally have in our games. And that is that separation between player and character. You're very strong within it to make sure that within your definition that people are effectively playing their character. That these investigators are someone who is separate and apart and must be thought of as that. And I think the composure bleeds this right into the pages, is that you have to think about how they are doing action to action. It's easy to lose that place in a character that, you know, in like D&D, who can go down to one hit point and still be 100% effective, and a lot of the other games, but having this effectively stat that is affecting your character at a level that is going to be physically visible at all times, that your investigator is effectively losing themselves on an emotional or physical level, like you were saying, they're exhausted, they're hungry. It all plays into that, but allows the player to narrate and describe and act as that through the scenes, and know that, you know, that they have a physical mechanic to lean on for that.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just, oh, you're injured, or oh, you have this condition. it is a
character is injured.
Correct. It feels that it leans back into this heavy concept that combat is exceptionally dangerous, even beyond your composure, because your composure leans into how well you're going to do at that. And I kind of want to take a step into that just for a second, because it is in its own right, its own mechanics. Not that, like, you have plenty of mechanics for other things, but you spend 80 pages. I think it's 80 pages currently. I'm sure it'll get compressed a little bit, but it's still a significant portion of your book that you talk about how combat actually flows. And it's mostly about what can happen. I think, Addison, since it's yours, do you want to step into that a little bit more, just so you could describe it, the impact on that? Because I know, yes, there's what we talk about. It's more than just firearms. It's more than just attacks.
Yeah. So, like, one of the reasons why we have, like, we do have 80 plus pages dedicated to, we have more pages dedicated to combat, I think, than investigation. But one of the reasons why that is that investigation is, even though that is something the investigators will be doing more of, it doesn't need as many rules. We were able to, like, lock down the rules for investigation in fewer pages.
Mm-hmm.
And also, that section of the book has actually been copy edited. And
that's true. We took, like, 25 pages or something.
Yeah, we removed at least 25 pages from that, of, like, various extraneous sentences and paragraphs that didn't need to be there. Or like, just making sentences shorter. Stuff like that. That's a good example of why we need a dedicated editor.
Ash, the Marie Kondo of tabletop RPGs.
Yes.
Whole pages. This does not spark joy.
Yeah. It does not spark joy.
Not to mention that it's mechanically heavy for combat. Mm.
It is somewhat mechanically heavy. It still uses the same 2d6 resolution system. And there's no... like, equivalent to AC or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you don't have to learn a whole new game to understand how the combat works. It's still just 2d6, failure, partial success, or full success.
But you added in a fun mechanic that I just have to ask. I think I now know where it came from, but you added in a woo roll.
That's W-O-O, yes, the woo rule.
So explain to me where this came from.
Okay. So, in Eureka, when a bullet is fired, or when a gun is fired, since there's a gun can fire multiple bullets on the same turn,
mm-hmm.
and there's still only one woo roll per instance of firing a gun. No, even if there's 10 bullets. We do actually, I think we have a rule that says you can make 10 woo rolls if you want, but we don't recommend it. So a woo roll is another dice that is rolled. It's still just a D6. And it determines what happens if the bullet misses its intended target.
Oof.
Ooh. Collateral damage.
Why do I always feel like this is something that is completely lacking in every other games? Is I'm like, I fire an arrow in a small room with a whole bunch of people in it. It misses. Okay, where does it go? It
disappears.
Savage Worlds has rules.
It doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But in Eureka, bullets they go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this can there's like a dedicated table for the woo roll. But that's only to be used when there's not an obvious result, because the rule is whatever's the most obvious result is what happens.
Mm-hmm.
If right. the and there's positive and negative we rolls. It, like the roll determines whether it's a positive effect or a negative effect. And a if the protagonist is going to try, if the villain has the hostage like held in front of him, mm-hmm. and the protagonist has got to shoot him out from behind the hostage, a full success on that gunshot roll would hit the intended target.
Mm-hmm.
A partial success would make the woo roll more likely to go positive, but it's not 100% guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
And a failure would make the woo roll more likely to be negative, but not 100% guaranteed to be negative either.
Gotcha. Like if it hits the fire extinguisher behind the guy, distracting him.
Gotcha.
Right, okay.
And which negative would almost certainly be hitting the hostage.
Right, probably. As it's what it's named after John Woo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
The director is specifically based on the movie Hard Boiled.
Oh,
have you ever seen that?
Very much so. I love Hard Boiled.
It is a movie with a lot of gunfighting, and every single one of those bullets that is fired by a character visibly hits something in the environment.
Yes.
Stuff like walls are exploding, bullet holes are appearing, everything, there's dust, there's smoke and debris, concrete columns are getting like chipped off, the drywall is flying everywhere every time someone fires a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why we named it that, because we wanted and that is somewhat exaggerated of realism, but it's more realistic than just the bullet not hitting and therefore having no effect.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a reason why gun ranges have a giant, like 20-foot thick dirt wall behind them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Even the ones with catch angling so that it's no matter what hits it, it's always going to rebound in a trajectory that's going to put it in a catch point, things like that. Right. Yeah, definitely.
Mm. Yeah. And I can tell you as a former 911 operator that guns, gunfights are messy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
And they break things all the time.
Yeah. 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 And right, and like, having that verisimilitude embedded already in the game, having gunfights be just as feeling as just as real and just as dangerous.
How'd that speech go from Mass Effect? Sir Isaac Newton is the meanest son of a bitch in the universe.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
Sorry, I was leaning into give a man a gun, he thinks he's Superman. Give him two, and he thinks he's a god.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh no, I was going for it. You know, the moment you pull that trigger, you have ruined somebody's day.
It's very true.
Yeah. And actually, I think my favorite example in, and I'm going to say playtesting, but this is just plain playing. Like, mm-hmm. we play this game a lot in our own group. But my favorite example of a woo roll was, and I'm not going to tell this entire scene, even mm-hmm. though the entire scene is awesome.
Okay.
But one investigator had been shot already and was about to be shot again. And this investigator was still standing because she was a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important to the to how this woo role played out. So the shooter is on the other side of the room and fires, and it's a miss, but the woo role is positive. And that is positive for the shooter. Meaning the effect will be beneficial to the shooter and negative to the investigator.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So instead of hitting the investigator, it blows out a window and cuts a streak of light across the room in between them.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Like letting sunlight into the room.
Okay.
And, yeah, no, that's great. That's great narratively.
Yeah.
Yeah, that in Eureka, sunlight is not instantly lethal to vampires, so that's not like a line of death. But it is something that she would have had to cross and be vulnerable for a second
Right, decisions still had to be made.
Right, right.
Right. It changed the environment entirely. And, like, that's what it's supposed to do.
I like that for a huge aspect because, like I was saying, in a lot of games where combat is important, it feels like that aspect of combat is lost. This like, bullets and flying things are dangerous. They just aren't. Like you said, they just disappear. They don't exist right. until combat's over, and then they're collecting them if you're in second edition.
Right, especially right. especially if you're coming from D&D, you know, it's just, you know, to hit roll, hit points. To hit roll, hit points,
yeah.
you know?
I mean, I honestly... I'm trying to remember if there was an edition of Shadowrun that deliberately put in ricochet. I know they had, like, chunky salsa for grenades. Like, the concept that that blowback does occur in a small box. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall that being a permanent rule. And I'll have to wait to see if Overwatch calls me out on that one. But I feel like in a game where you're literally... With spray is a term...
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Spray is a term.
Like
in Eureka,
you think that would be kind of important for the hotel to begin, and you've given it its importance. Like if a guy grabs an Uzi and sprays down a room, that's significant. Like
yes.
by any standard, especially when you're a squishy human who probably isn't wearing body armor because there's no right. reason why you should be wearing body armor, nor should you be the recipient of an Uzi spray.
Right.
You've done something critically wrong in your life when that happens.
Right. And actually, speaking of hit points, this is maybe something a bit interesting to bring up, is that despite having two health tracks, the superficial HP and the penetrative HP, Eureka actually barely has HP as a concept.
Right.
Different characters do not have different levels of HP. Every yeah. human character, and that it does include, like, a vampire. Vampire's counting as a human character.
Right, right.
Every guy with two arms and two legs.
So yeah, pretty much everybody has, five hit points.
Effective. Effectively
five hit points, and a bullet does four.
Yeah.
Yes.
A bullet does four.
When a character is reduced to one hit point, they have to make a check, or else... be incapacitated.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes total sense.
And if they're... am I remembering correctly that if they're incapacitated, they can choose instead to take a grievous injury?
A grievous wound.
And yes. so we're talking, like, possibly permanent...
Like missing limb.
Like, yeah, like, I was shot in the thigh, and now my character will walk with a cane for the rest of their career.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually, this is just a quick design note for anyone who's looking to design their own game. Make sure that your mechanics come into play. All of the damage numbers are even so that the injury mechanics, like, happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it has the weight. It carries the weight through play.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And have either of you ever played the more recent Hitman games?
I have not played it, but I am an avid watcher of, like, speedruns and stuff and let's yeah. plays and such like that. So okay. I'm at least from passingly familiar.
Agreed.
Then you know that when you walk Agent 47 up to any guy and you press the attack button, it's not a fight. It's not really combat. It just does an animation and he either knocks him out or kills him, depending on what weapon he mm-hmm. has.
Right, right.
Eureka works somewhat like that. It, despite having intense combat rules, it will come down to one or two dice rolls.
Yeah, yeah. It's very quick, very brutal.
And characters are going to be going down in one hit or two hits.
Yeah.
Almost yeah. in every time.
Really makes you think twice about engaging in combat unless you absolutely know you have the upper hand. And if you right. don't, it makes fleeing from combat a very attractive option.
I have right. to say that after talking to you all and looking over the combat section, I came to the realization that Gross Point Blank, the scene where it's Dan Aykroyd and him literally sitting in a small room with firearms deciding when they're going to stand up and shoot kind of a thing, is very much that. There's a lot of chaos and bullets hitting things, and they are both very scared for the moment when one of those bullets hits them. And they're both professionals
yeah.
at
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And all this, you know, all this in service of a mechanic, which realistically, if it comes up in a game, it's almost a failure state.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
which is great.
Can I also just say that I adore that on the character sheet there is a place, a sort of a paper doll for you to note the location and severity and type of your grievous injuries. That is a chalk outline.
Yes.
of a body.
Exceptionally perfect. Up there.
Exactly.
A sort of memento mori that death could be around every corner.
Let's actually step into character creation a little bit. I know some people are interested because we've kind of talked about the investigators a little bit. I'm going to read another quote from the book that I thought was a great way of stating it, and that is, this is a game about flawed, ordinary people attempting to get to the bottom of or survive extraordinary situations. And when you look at characters, they aren't heroic. They aren't exceptional specimens, if you will. You're designing a character with both strengths and flaws in that balance, and I saw that that point spread of in creating your character out and went and saw the way that you had weighted it in the sense that it has to total out your positives and your negatives, and it reminded
has to zero sum is what you're talking about. Your positives and your negatives have to zero sum.
So although it's a little crunchy in that math, it's very basic. It's it harkens back to some other older systems actually that used that design of like, oh yeah, you can take all these things, but you're gonna have a ton of flaws.
Yep,
you're gonna suck at some stuff right off the bat. Where did that come from, that older style? Was there like a root there that you saw and you were like, this is where we need to sit this? Or was it more about the flaw of humanity?
It has to do actually with the separation of... It actually has a little bit to do with the separation of player and character. Or rather, these are both in service of the same thing, I guess.
Okay.
That's why, like, I prefer that you say, like, your investigator skills instead of your skills.
Right.
And stuff like that. Even, like, in the podcast, even when, like, talking about it.
Well, like, when you're talking about you've got, let's see here, interpersonal knowledge, physical, and uncategorized skills. That sit in any normal, like a relatively crunchy state, but you're not going to have points in all of them. Nor are you going to necessarily have positive points in all of them.
Right. Because where you give to one, you have to take from another.
To balance out that flaw of humanity, if you will.
Yeah, so the one... So, it might be... It's one of the reasons is because... I'm trying to remember how I planned to say this.
You're fine. You've had a long day.
Yes, I have. So the reason why it has to zero out like that is because it's something that's like pretty easily balanceable by us, the game designers. That definitely influenced the decision to go that way, but it also makes the player write the flaws into their character in a way that, because it oftentimes, at least if you're coming from something like D&D 5th edition that is all about like power, like heroic power fantasy,
min-maxing,
having a character like be overtly bad at things is very unintuitive for character creation. So, like, being good at things for a character is obviously super desirable. But in Eureka, what we want, and this is counterintuitive, probably, at least sounding counterintuitive, we want a character being bad at things to also be good. Because, well, first of all, when investigating, when a skill is used to investigate something, a failure gives the character more investigation points, which would then build up to it.
Well, I don't think we've covered that yet.
Yeah, we're getting into that right now. Yeah,
today yet. But just listeners, hold on to that. We'll explain investigation points shortly.
Yep. Definitely getting there.
But they're a good thing. So failing gives more of them, and succeeding gives less of them. Mm-hmm. So failure is good in that way. And failure is, especially in a game like Eureka, also very fun. So, like, I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned her by name, but Yvette is a character who is like a flagship character of Eureka. And she's going to come up in a lot of examples, both in this podcast and in like the examples of play in the book. She is exceptionally bad in her interpersonal skills.
Same. I feel that.
You don't know the half of it. her stats have fluctuated slightly because we do also encourage like minor respecking of characters.
Sure, sure.
Over time, but she's changed slightly, but for a long time she was flat -3 across the entire almost the entire interpersonal set of skills. Oh, wow. But anyway,
And that's basically maximum like bonus and detriment is +3, -3, right?
Right.
So that's literally as bad as you can get without taking additional penalties on top of it.
Especially when you're only rolling 2d6.
Yeah.
Yeah, because of certain traits and things, she actually has a -5 in comfort.
Oh my goodness. Oof.
Anyway, so she, watching her walk straight in and very confidently fail any kind of interaction like that is it always gets a laugh at the table.
She can never encounter a teenager being like rude to her and not go ballistic about it and not get super petty.
Oh God.
Oh wow.
It's really funny.
In fact, can you please stop fighting children?
Maybe an exaggeration.
Ballistic exaggeration.
But yes, she will have to have the last word, yes. And anyway, so what we don't want, so that is an example of two examples of how failure is good in Eureka, both mechanically because it gets investigation points and, you know, not mechanically or outside the game because it's very funny. And so therefore we do not want players to be afraid of their investigator failing. And that is one of the reasons that separation of player and character come in.
Right.
So, like, when the character screws up, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have screwed up, the player.
Right.
If the whole table's laughing at... If you've been saying, like, the entire session, like, I swing my sword, and then your character is just made an absolute fool of... then it can feel like you're being laughed at, or if it can feel bad to you. But if you are not, you are adamantly not your character, and they are like a different person.
Well,
and like that is established, then like you can very much very easily laugh at them as well.
And to say the least, like especially with a lot of people coming into D&D tables and games that are very crunchy and OSR, where you know, planning, tactics, making the making sure your team is cohesive, that you've got everything. It's you playing through a board game interface and making the right decisions for what's at the table. And this kind of
interesting characters do not always make the right decisions.
Well, nothing fun ever happened from a salad.
Yeah, except
for the pictures of people holding salads and laughing. I really want to know what's going on in those stories, but. But to take it to that level is that you do feel a level of humiliation because you didn't make... I mean, I know that I have read enough Reddit posts about people like, oh, I did the wrong roll and my table, you know, got up on me. I need to learn how to play a ranger better. It's like, what? Better?
Yeah.
Like,
this isn't a digital game. You're not min-maxing and then having to do the strategy perfect. But people played even Baldur's Gate that way. And it detracts from the feeling of being able to enjoy being a character. We hear it about it, you know. One of my players came to my table and said that they didn't want to use the standard array. They wanted to have a negative in their intelligence so that their character could be a little flawed. How do I talk them out of that? Like, why would you want to?
That's,
you know. Yeah. And in this, you guys are encouraging that separation of this isn't a tactical game. This is a play. You are playing a character, you know, who has flaws. They are not you making those decisions.
And flawed characters sometimes make stupid, impulsive, unskilled, maladroit decisions.
Correct. And terrible things happen.
Yep.
And then you all laugh, and we move on.
Yep.
Well, and awesome. I mean, importantly, you know, not only is it funny, but failures are also dramatic and contribute to the story. Like, you know, a character failing or making ill-advised like making ill-advised decisions, that's at the crux of drama and at the crux of like tragedy.
Right.
Well, let's talk then a little bit about that. Let's jump to gameplay. So this is an investigative game. We have rules for investigation. Can you take us through a little bit of how that kind of looks?
Yeah, so because we just promised the audience we would explain investigation.
Yep. Yes.
Characters have their set of skills, and it's about, I think, about 20 skills at default. We wanted to have like basically as many, like, we want to have the bare minimum number of skills that could cover just about every situation. And then we also left blanks in the sheet where a player can come up with their own skill. I remember one campaign, somebody had like AC repair. I don't remember, but it was, and it was used. It was used as a skill. It wasn't to repair an AC, but it was to like, it was an investigation check to like understand how an AC had been tampered with.
Okay.
Because skills, there is no investigation skill in Eureka. All skills are investigation skills, even firearms.
And I love
is
that
an investigation skill.
Yeah, there's no reason why as a blacksmith that I can't look at metal and use that to investigate something that happened with armor that I'm looking at. Like, oh,
right.
This metal is very thin, which means that whatever pierced it was sharp enough to deform it and cut into it.
This gun is obviously a fake. Why? Because the steel on it should be a lot harder, and this has gouges in it from where it skidded across the floor.
Right. Yeah. You know, yours says replica, and mine says 0.50.
Yes, yeah.
Desert Eagle, you know? And that's, it's those types of things. It's like, it's a minor thing. But at the same time, it's what you know coming to the table,
you know.
And in this case, it's what the investigator has learned in their life and their experiences coming forward to make it successful.
Right. So any skill can be used to investigate a thing, and the way that works is, let's say it's. We could even use firearms. So the firearm skill, obviously, it dictates how like accurate a character is when shooting a gun and how fast they can reload and other things like that. But it's also an investigation skill because the reason that they are accurate and the reason they can reload fast is they know a lot about guns. So if there's a... let's say that there's some empty cartridges at the crime scene. And obviously it's written on those what caliber they are. But they could pick one of those up and make an investigation check using the firearm skill. And with a success in that, they would probably be able to come up with a good idea of what type of firearm fired those bullets. So... maybe let's say with a failure, they would be like, as a narrator, I would probably say this character, if they can't come up with anything right now, it could be, there's too many options. With a partial success, I might say like, these are 9mm cartridges. There's guns that use 9mm off the top of this character's head are, lots of Berettas, Glocks, HMKs, things like that. And then with a full success, I would, as a narrator, I would give that information. Plus, I'd probably say, but you know, knowing the likelihood of or the because this character is a gun nut, they know, you know, the statistics of who owns what kind of guns in this state. Like, what's the most popular sidearm in this state? And they may be able to make a pretty good guess that it was a Glock, or probably a Glock.
I want to talk about that failure and partial success outcome a little bit.
Because investigation points.
Yes.
Well, yeah, it's doing two things right. First off, it fills the investigation bars. It gives investigation points. So how that works is the investigation point bar, which is like 15 points to get a Eureka point, is the standard. So every roll fills that bar. Investigation rolls will always give at least 1 point in it, even with a full success. Failures give more points. They give 3 points. Once that bar fills all the way up, the investigator gets a Eureka point, which can do a couple of really interesting things. One is something you've probably seen in a lot of games. You know, spend a narrative point and get like a bonus to a roll, basically. But the second thing is more interesting. And it can reverse a failed investigation roll. So what that means is, you know, if a character, wasn't able to get the information on what type of sidearm is commonly owned in this state, and that's something that is potentially blocking progress off in the investigation. You know, they can't get a lead with that information. They spend a Eureka point. They have a Eureka moment. That's why the game is called Eureka.
Mm-hmm.
And they realize, wait, that type of gun is probably going to be like a, you know, a Glock 21 or something. I don't know guns. And
you're fine.
And that was, we saw that gun come up on like a receipt somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it takes what would have been something like, it takes a roll result that would have stymied progress in the game, mm-hmm. and makes it into a rewarding moment that, that moves it forward and like lets the investigation continue and makes the failure feel rewarding.
Right. And you were, when your character fails an investigation check, you were supposed to write that down. There's a section in the character sheet for that. You write that down, like failed check, bullet cartridges in alleyway. And then, so you remember that that's something that could be like reversed and have a Eureka point used on it.
And it almost leans into the fact that, like, well, later on where you're somewhere else completely, like, maybe you're going through airport security or something, and you're where the killer could have gone through, and you investigate something and you get 1 point there because you're successful. You know, that 1 point pushes you over to get you a Eureka point. And you're like, wait a second, it was ceramic. It's a ceramic 9mm. Crap, that's how he got it through.
Right.
It wasn't in the metal detector because it was all ceramic.
You see that all the time in like movies and stuff of that where like someone will be sitting at a diner and like the waitress will say something to them and they'll be like, oh, yeah. Wait a minute, yeah. Thank you. I love you. Kisses the waitress and runs out.
Yep, exactly.
That's perfect. That's exactly what it's evoking.
Yes. And I love it mechanically because it also, like, you were kind of touching on this, I believe, Ash, where it acts as a fail-safe for failed investigation roles stymieing an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
D&D players, you know what sucks? failing a perception check.
Failing a perception check, and you just didn't notice the thing you needed to get to the next plot point. So I guess we're going to wander around in the Lost Mines of Phandelver. Yeah. You know how they became the Lost Mines? They failed a perception check, too. Yes.
Exactly.
Everyone failed a perception check. Which is another thing that's about it is that there's nothing wrong with people examining the same crime scene and getting different results. Like, if I'm not successful, there's nothing to say that you won't be successful looking at the exact same thing from a different perspective.
Right, because Poirot is going to see something different than Columbo will.
100%.
Yeah.
Like, I might be looking at that cigarette because I'm an avid smoker and I know cigarettes.
Oh, yeah, whereas, just one more thing.
Yeah, whereas, like, you might be looking at that cigarette because you're a runner and there's a footprint on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, nobody stepped on that one to put it out. Someone ran through here with track shoes.
Yeah, it's
the same crime scene looked at from different angles, which is exactly the point of investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't stop that. It doesn't stop that movement of knowledge and information as it passes moment to moment with each one of the characters. And again, as the investigators fail the roles and mark those, it can still come back later.
Yep.
It could still be reused.
Three scenes away, you could build up enough investigation points to get a eureka and come back to that one scene, you know, the bullet casings you haven't been talking about for 45 minutes, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that. Let's see here.
Where did we leave off? Time ticks. I think that's another one to step into. So, when I was looking through and kind of getting a feel for like how the narrator can step into this, one of the things that you guys have listed was this idea of time passing, but it's not used in the same format that a lot of games do, where they're using it at the meta level, the player level. This is actually happening at the investigator level. This is happening to the characters, and time is passing for them. Which is something I really don't see very often. Can one of you speak into that a little bit more of the choice for doing that? Was it a stress mechanic?
Yeah, so I mean the it's a mystery and horror game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eureka is supposed to be tense. The investigations are supposed to be tense, particularly for the investigators, if not the players. And the ticking clock mechanic is adding another layer onto that. In most stories, you'll see there is some kind of race against the clock element in these mysteries. You know, they've got to find who done it before they leave town, or they've got to find a solution to like deal with this monster that is locked in with them, like an alien. You know, before some way to deal with this before they all die or something, right? Before time runs out,
before they take another victim,
yeah.
You know,
and mm-hmm. and the ticking clock mechanic is a way to kind of emulate that, where you have these basically a set resource, which is every time the investigators go to a new location, every time they take a little extra time finding some information out, every time they go somewhere and interview someone, that is all, and every time they have to take a break to eat because they don't want to starve.
Right, the whole composure mechanic.
Exactly. Every time they have to sleep for the night, that is all time that they are spending. You know, the clock is ticking, daylight's burning, and they've got to. This is supposed to encourage the kind of behaviors that you see in detective fiction. Why would the investigators stake a place out all night? I mean, just of course to watch it, but also because they don't have infinite time to solve the mystery.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They need to meet the deadline. They have things that they need to do in a certain period of time. So it's just another element to manage on top of you know, keeping one's mental health in check and like trying to get as much information as possible. There's not enough resources to get it done perfectly. You're never going to I guess S rank. A Eureka,
yeah, right.
Adventure module, right?
Right. And I think that too plays a lot into the whole, you know, investigators are flawed people who make unsound decisions. When you start putting a time crunch on them like that, and you start having to make decisions between do I regain composure or do I continue my investigation, knowing that not regaining my composure will make that next step subpar. You know, and then you've got this time crunch mechanic on top of all of it. It can start forcing poor decisions.
But it also, I think that it removes the concern of what we traditionally have in other games of optimization.
Yeah.
You know, and you can not be optimized, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's meant to be a story that, and you reiterate this in the book, that this isn't something to win. This isn't something to not try to be successful at, but there's a solid chance that the monster's, you know, or the killer's going to get away because you can't meet the you run out of time or they just get away. They find their space to sneak out. But it doesn't mean you don't that the investigators don't learn. They don't discover that there isn't some kind of a story to a mystery that evolves a little bit more. It feels very X-File-y, right? Where like X-Files wasn't about solving. They would try, but those characters rarely got the complete solution. And oftentimes it things just hung in the air, like sometimes like a fart in the car, but it was still compelling. It still left you in awe of the moment. And I think this does a great job of that and giving you the right to do that. And to say that, and I'm going to step into one other point here, is that these investigators don't advance. You have no advancement mechanic. If I'm not reading that wrong.
No, that's true.
There's a very slight, listed as optional rule, advancement mechanic. Which I will not get into because it's an optional rule, and when we play at our table, we do not use it.
Well, it almost feels like it detracts from the system. From this design is that you eventually could have an investigator who was successful, like almost too successful.
Yeah. So there is no investment. In fact, like we do encourage some degree of respecking between adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Moving a few points around. There's not a set number that can be moved. It's free form.
Mm-hmm.
Although, like, honestly, I'd say as far as stats go, most of the time, investigator stats could probably only mainly go down because grievous wounds tend to reduce stats pretty seriously.
I would think so.
I'm sorry, like, wait. Where did this go? Where do we get to know? Oh yeah,
there's no advancement.
Yeah.
Well, before how do we get to know advancement?
Oh, when we were talking about the time and being able to your characters to feel or the investigators feeling flawed and being allowed to be flawed and have this stress and the chance for failure. Failure isn't a thing in the game so much as it's not so much win and loss that failure is an option, and that's fine.
Right. We want the occasional Eureka adventure to end in failure. Whether that be a party wipe or whether that just be the bad guy got away, or something. And that is a failure state for the investigators in the world of the game.
Mm-hmm.
It may not necessarily be a failure state for the the players, because the way that works is they're going to be having a great time. Like it's like I mentioned, Yvette failing. Actually, maybe this is a good time to bring up something that I don't think we had in our notes, but the truth mechanic. When we're talking about like flawed characters that's oftentimes will make bad decisions.
Yeah, sure.
Every investigator has one or more quote unquote truths. And these are like kind of core aspects of their personality or things that like strong beliefs or in general things that drive them. One of the only rules is that a truth has to be something that would drive them to action, an aspect of their personality that would drive them to action. And whenever an investigator does an action that is like very in line with their truth, they get a plus one bonus to the next five checks. It helps the player answer the question of what would this character do in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look at their truths. They have a hot temper. So if someone's starting to mess with them, they're going to lose their temper. it also will be a catalyst for often be a catalyst for investigators making decisions that are not necessarily the best and most coldly logical decision. It's very easy when you're sitting around a table and you're not in the warehouse or in the ancient mines or in the abandoned amusement park to think of things with perfect cold logic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that means that characters in TTRPGs don't often make those choices. Except in Eureka, they are mechanically rewarded for doing so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which can cause investigators to do a bunch of
pretty suboptimal things
yeah, that are maybe suboptimal for a completely robotic mystery solving machine, which mm-hmm. the investigators are not.
Right.
But it is optimal for a good story. Let me think. A good example of a truth being used is going back to Yvette. One of her truths is that she basically can't turn down a challenge.
Okay.
Not as any point of honor, but her she just has that much of an ego. I don't remember how it came up, but
are you going to talk about the coffee run story?
Yes, the coffee run. where essentially
a character, a clerk at a county office wanted the party to go fetch him a coffee so he would help out.
Okay.
A very trivial task. Just a formality, really.
Yes.
And Yvette took it as a tour de force?
Well, one of the other investigators, I don't remember how that came about, but she essentially, in so many words, told Yvette that she could run and get it faster.
Gotcha.
Which prompted essentially an impromptu race, in which Yvette made it to this coffee shop like a block down in seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And got back with the coffee, and that going like her doing that is something that was acting in her truth. So she started getting the plus one bonus. Although actually she has plus two because she has a trait
mm-hmm.
Called predictable that doubles the bonus from acting in her truth. And so she had like plus two bonuses to her next five checks. And right when she got back and started actually like looking into the records at the county seat, that plus two bonus was the difference between a partial success and a full success, or maybe it was a failure and a partial success, but it tipped the dice result into the next degree of success.
Gotcha. Okay.
All right. So and the bottom line is that like rewarding staying in character, basically made this extremely petty need to beat a teenager in a race contribute to solving the mystery.
Mm-hmm,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, I absolutely love that.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of Savage Worlds. Savage Worlds has a kind of a similar mechanic with hindrances, and they encourage you to give out bennies, which is their meta currency, for role-playing your hindrances and stuff like that. And I make that a pretty regular occurrence at my table. Whenever anybody leans into their hindrances, you always reward it because it's never to the player's or to the character's benefit to do so.
Yeah, I definitely see like the weight difference between Savage World and this is that Savage World, it's a Benny is nice. It does have a certain weight within the system. Now, granted,
I mean, the Benny's a straight up reroll. I mean, it literally turns failure into success.
It's also something you're relatively sitting on in most cases. Whereas this, it's you really like having five rolls that are all beneficial.
That's
a very weighty,
meaty
thing, especially if you're doing something that you're not necessarily. You know, your character's doing something that they're not necessarily good at.
Right.
The next step, but like they need a little pick me up, if you will.
Yeah.
You know,
and carrying around a +2 to your die rolls when 10 is considered a full success.
Right.
Is mathematically pretty heavy.
Yeah. Very much so. Very much so. No, I like that. I like that a lot. So,
you want to get into your favorite part, which is the narrator section?
I kind of do, and we've danced through this a couple of different times in talking about the concept of the investigations. And I know we didn't get into the two tracks that you guys describe within the book, but one of the key things here that I want to talk about in regards to investigation is that you naturally within the writing of this. You're not leaning into giving the party any benefits. You know, as a narrator, I'm not changing the architecture of the story to adapt for what they figure out. You know, and I say this in another systems method. A lot of times narrators will be listening to the table chatter of players, less the characters, and kind of seeing what they come up with. And this game doesn't do that. This is about what do they find at the scene, what do they investigate, how do they figure that out. And you go so far as to say in the book, they have eyes, ears, and eureka points. If you've followed all the advice above and they still can't solve the mystery, it's on them, not you. And they should be allowed to fail. Now, it's kind of a cold statement to put in there, but at the same time, with everything else that's framed in the gameplay, it makes sense, but I have to ask, in spending hours in my own games outside of Eureka, of players coming up with wild red herring situations that, you know, their characters think, you know, oh, it's got to be X, Y, or Z that have nothing to do with the current situation, do you find that that's true? In this, or do you find that the system, you know, through your playtesting, that this works way more successfully?
For listeners at home, the narrator is the game master. That's just I didn't know if we had outlined that in this episode so far. But, okay, so this, I can see how that might scare a lot of people reading that, actually. But this has not been a problem when it comes to actually like playing the game. It says they have eyes, ears, and eureka points.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an idea the concept of like spending hours and hours and getting nowhere for the party. That does sound in theory frustrating. Or on paper, that sounds frustrating,
mm-hmm.
but this, like, first of all, this hasn't really happened. Like, players and their investigators have proven pretty effective at coming to mostly correct conclusions derived from what they learned in, like, basically all of our gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
No matter who's taking the role of game master and who's, because we rotate. And Eureka is very good for that, with an episodic, like, taking it episodically. And like rotating in and out characters, but in the few situations where the investigators like come to an incorrect conclusion and like come up with nothing, like even in actual games that we've seen play where that happens, and I think this has only happened one time.
As far as I'm aware, it's only happened in the game I'm running right now.
Yeah, I think it's only
Where Yvette spent basically an entire session chasing her tail, and running into dead end after dead end, and just not discovering a whole lot. But her fumbling her way through all these dead ends and getting, like, tearing her hair out, just finding the same information over and over again, was first off very funny. Yes. And secondly, when she did get to the end of that, she was able to, with those investigation points. Mm-hmm. She was getting investigation points making these rolls. She was able to use the Eureka points she gained during that session to find a tangible leak. So even though, you know, that was how we ended the session. So even though it was, you know, it feels frustrating. It sounds frustrating to just find nothing. In practice, it was fun. But even if it wasn't.
That's only happened one time.
That's only happened one time.
In like 2 years of playing.
Yeah. It's that concept that we were kind of talking about was that in most games, like they want you to be very explicit about what truths are and being almost breaking the meta layer to tell, the players what the truths are. But again, we're not talking to players. We're talking to the investigators. The investigators are looking for evidence. They're the ones digging into this. And like you said, with the Eureka points, you will get to a conclusion that is successful to be able to move yourself forward, to know all the facts. It doesn't necessarily tell you what the answer is. And there's a beauty to that build, to that success, and watching the story unfold for these investigators as they're moving moment to moment and making discoveries. Right. And not just exposing, a traditional DM like, you look behind the painting and find, you know, the signature, which means that the Duke is they could figure that out from the signature.
They could, yeah.
Right.
And like, even, and then if they couldn't figure that out from the signature, and let's say that they have no Eureka points, which wouldn't happen because the investigation points and Eureka points are really easy to get. If you're playing the game right, even if they're going to do all this and like the investigators still come to a complete dead end and fail, and they have nothing to go on, and the bad guy just gets away because they can't move forward in the case, or they die because they thought they were dealing with a werewolf, and it turns out they're dealing with a vampire, and they didn't bring the right stuff. And then they die. Like that is still something that we, like the rulebook expressly says for the game master to allow to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the game master doesn't allow that to happen, or wouldn't have allowed that to happen, if the game master takes away the party's ability to fail,
mm-hmm.
the game master takes away the party's ability to succeed. Because if they had the, like, if you're bowling, mm-hmm. okay, and they inflate those, like, baby barriers is the only thing that I...
The bumpers, yeah.
The bumpers. If they inflate the bumpers to, like, completely lock out the gutters, meaning that the ball will always hit the pins, no matter what, you can't, it doesn't really... I mean, maybe that's a bad analogy, but I think you get mm-hmm. what I'm going for.
Yeah.
If you couldn't have failed in the first place, because you've entered the cheat code in your video game to like turn on God mode, or because every time you like have your character run towards the spike trap, mm-hmm. the narrator or game master like, turns out the spike trap was actually to the left, and mm-hmm. Grunthar the Barbarian is fine.
Yeah.
Like, that means that neither the players nor the investigators really succeeded of their own accord.
They just completed it.
They just sat down at the table for long enough for the narrator to finish telling them a story.
Right.
That's... they decided to write the names of the protagonists of, but otherwise just sort of went through the motions in.
Mm-hmm.
They did like just press X to, you know, move to the next scene of like to roll the dialogue forward.
I think that, Eureka in its design always tries to treat both the players and the investigators as though they are smart and as though they are capable and they are able to succeed on their own merits, even if there was a legitimate risk of failure.
Yeah. Right.
That risk being there is why their success is good and fun. And like, you know, narratively valuable.
Yeah, the flavor of the fruit is sweeter when you have to fight to get it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the Dark Souls of investigation.
It kind of is. Yes. Like, it is. I think that's a solid analogy of it.
I'll very, very proudly take that.
Excellent.
Very big fan of the Souls games. And one of the reasons being is why is that they're not like stupid, unfair, hard.
Nope, but they say here is the game mechanics. You either engage with them or you don't. Mm-hmm. And if you do, you will be rewarded.
Yes.
Yeah.
It also gives speedrunning in that game a totally different feel. But it cheapens the speedrun because you're not engaging.
All right. Yeah. Eureka, no hit, broken sword, run, let's go.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Now, I don't want to go too far away from this because there's one piece that we talked about that I felt was an emotional draw for me of this game.
Okay.
It gave me a different perspective on it the moment we started talking about that. And it was where you were talking about the monsters. And that even though this game sits at the point of what would a human do, that's true for them. That they are flawed. One of the points that you made was that vampires can't regain composure like humans. They can't just take a nap or eat a sandwich. They have to go hunt. They have to go bleed something. And whether they have a problem with it or not, that's life. And these vampires are not Vampire the Masquerade vampires. To give it a perspective in design, and I thought it was funny when I brought this up and how easily you guys accepted it, was you talk about them almost in the same light of what we do in the shadows, except without the comedy. They're people. They're trying to survive in this contemporary space, and it's a struggle. You know, in some cases, they're hundreds of years old, and, like, they don't have infinite resources. That doesn't work that way. A 100-year-old person isn't rich over a 20-year-old person. They have just as many struggles, if not more, because—and I think this was the key, was that you stated that they were flawed. They have a disability.
Yes.
And you said that the system is compassionate. Can you speak to that?
Okay. There's like a bunch of different ways I could approach this subject, and give me just a second because I have choice paralysis on all different things because this is like the most deeply thematic thing in the entire game. You mentioned last time we talked, that wasn't recorded, which we keep calling back to because we had a really good
talk. It's always fun doing this.
We ended up just talking a bunch after we confirmed the mics work. And then we talked for like another half hour or 2 hours even maybe. You said that most TTRPGs are just like, oh, monsters are evil.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, monsters in Eureka are incentivized to hunt other people and prey upon other people because it's how they restore their composure. Like you mentioned, a vampire gets nothing from eating a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a regular, normal investigator, they would, if they eat 3 sandwiches a day, they get a point of composure back.
Mm-hmm.
They naturally regain composure over time, even if they're like under a lot of stress, just by eating and sleeping, they get 2 points of composure back a day.
Mm-hmm.
And these vampires, you're going to use vampires, even though there's like 5 playable monsters,
mm-hmm.
Almost all of which eat people, in some way or another. if we have time for it, we might get into the thing from beyond. That seems to be a new crowd favorite.
Hmm.
But anyway, the vampires are not like a slave to their hunger. Like a Eureka vampire is never going to see someone get a paper cut and then have to pounce on them immediately.
Oh, okay. Yeah. They're not Twilight. Got it.
You're right. But it's blood is their food. And they can't get it from a blood bank either. It has to be living blood straight from the source.
Right.
And there's a lot of, like, basically, I practically got a PhD in folkloric studies for this. But there's a reason for that I won't get into for time reasons. Mm-hmm. But it's their food. And eating their food hurts people.
Mm-hmm.
I at least assume that everyone in this chat right now eats food mm-hmm. daily. You, like, under most circumstances, if you just saw a plate of French fries, you also, much like you wouldn't lose control and die for it, you know?
I don't know, man. McDonald's fries are pretty good.
I think there's something to be said about that.
Yeah, but, okay, so you are not a slave to your hunger,
mm-hmm.
but you still eat every day.
It's still a service that you must perform for yourself to survive.
Yes, if, like, you could stop eating. Any one of us could be like, all right, I'm going to stop eating. I'm done eating. Ever.
Right.
And you could say that. And you could try it, but, like, how long would you last?
Precisely until the next nacho is in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, like how long would you last? And yeah, that's a good point, because just any person is a plate of nachos to them.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how long you might last 2 days? I would give you 2 days
mm-hmm.
Without food before you, like, you're like you're like, all right, like, that's enough, you know. And this is, so, this, in a lot of ways,
Well, it humanizes them. It takes a vampire and turns it on its head. It's not a gorgeous creature of the night who does something terrible on occasion, but could be, could be thought of as something very exotic, you know, and they
tragic
make
and romantic. Yeah.
No, this is a hurt person who is surviving.
This is essentially a human with an eating disorder.
Yeah.
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 Effectively.
Or you can even say, or like a poor person.
Yeah.
Someone who is, cause you need money to buy food.
Yeah.
Somebody, you have no money, you have no food.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody walking down a dark alley by themselves, not paying attention to anything, has money. You would be tempted, at least, to take that from them
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
if you had the opportunity and get that money so that you can get some food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and this in America, like, there's a tendency to think of, like, criminality and, like, harmfulness as resulting from, like, an intrinsic evil.
Like a moral failure, but oftentimes it's a crime of desperation instead, mm-hmm. yeah.
But, yeah, like, a lot of... And there's a lot to be said for, like, schools and stuff like that, but, like...
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is... But really, from my experience and observation, it doesn't... Like, people don't wake up and decide at the age of, like, 16 to be like, all right, I think that I've decided to go down the criminal life path.
Right.
Like, it's their circumstances that make them desperate typically. And that will wear on your morals and force you into situations
mm-hmm.
where it doesn't seem quite as outlandish that you might hurt someone to get what you need to live.
Yeah, I mean, I
think that
I dare say that this does a better job than anything that I've seen in handling that
Thank you.
That difference between, like, in D&D, there's no reason why the goblins are doing what they're doing, or the ogres are. They're evil. They're conquering.
Yeah, they're
what,
evil.
Like, you have to make an excuse, but if you were like, no, goblins need to eat, you know, their weight in mushrooms a week, right? That's a thing, right? That it's that simple. Okay, all the mushrooms are gone because they're being harvested by humans. Well, now there's a reason why the goblins are going to town. And they don't have money, right? They're going to go steal, and when stealing doesn't work out and a few of them get captured and they don't understand why their friends are being captured, now they're going to get drastic. They're going to do some rescues. Like, it adds a sense of, like you always say, humanity to it. A realism. Verisimilitude that connects it to reality, that we now have feeling and emotion that's tied to the mechanics, a reason for it. So, like, when I look, I loved Vampire the Masquerade. It was a great, you know, a great system for what it was, and its humanity mechanics were good at telling you when you did something wrong and kind of giving you a weight to it, but it really never felt like there was a reason for it. Like, oh yeah, I need blood because I used some. Not because I needed it. Like, if I didn't use any of my powers, it wasn't like my blood was going down anytime soon. Right? I could technically walk. There was no drive for it. Other than to say that I could lose it over time. But this adds a mechanical weight to who you are.
Yes. And, like, although the use of supernatural powers does have the potential to drain composure.
Right.
Like, that kind of exertion does have the potential to drain composure very slowly. And also, monsters suffer more, because monsters have, remember, composure is a cap to a character's stat modifiers.
Yes.
And the lower it is, the lower their maximum stat modifiers can be. And monsters, because they have superhuman abilities, will often have, like, stat modifiers in the, like, 5, 6, and 7s, when normally it just goes up to +3.
Mm-hmm.
And you have 7 composure for each character. Meaning that when a normal human has lost 2 composure, it could still operate at peak effectiveness. When a vampire has lost 2 composure, they are still more effective than a human, or a normal human, since they're also human. But they are not operating at full effectiveness. And this is another thing that kind of pushes the character towards the drinking of blood. That's like another, all right, another element. You mentioned disability, and another element. So these monsters, and, like, we're just going to use the vampire as the default monster.
Sure.
Eureka often does use the vampire as the default monster, even though there's 5 of them and they all play very differently. But these monsters are, I don't know about the word evil, but they are legitimately harmful and, like, threatening people. They are dangerous people, and they hurt innocent people. Like, they're not, this is not one of those settings that, like, where, like, vampires are the harmless victims of, like, a baseless prejudice from the church. Or something like that. These vampires are dangerous. They drink blood. They drink people's blood. And there's a deliberate that is a deliberate point, because Eureka, or I guess I and Eureka by extension, would very strongly assert that despite them being harmful, they are literally a drain on society. They still have an inherent value and, like, a right to life and a right to do what they need to do to live. Like, I mean, all right, even in, like, so-called progressive spaces, it's very easy for disabled people who can't work for any reason to be, like, considered to be, like, takers. Because, you know, they take resources and they don't create resources. And therefore, quote unquote, logically, they need to be pruned. And this is stuff that like people have like said to me,
mm-hmm.
this is not like a hypothetical straw man. Like these are, I'm like reciting talking points
mm-hmm.
here. And like, the one part of the intentional monster design there is that they are takers,
mm-hmm.
but by the way that they are intentionally framed here, they're not just like the evil goblins
mm-hmm.
that do evil for no reason. They are like, well, they take because they need to.
Mm-hmm.
That's their lot in life. Mm-hmm. They don't just, you can't turn it off. You can't turn right. off vampirism.
Right.
They're going to be a vampire like for all time. And like,
this isn't curing the monster.
Right. They are not going to be cured. They're always going to be a vampire. Like, okay. Like monsters, especially monsters that have been in the social zeitgeist for so long, like vampires for literally hundreds of years, like they have a set of themes
mm-hmm.
that are associated with them really hard. And not every one of those themes will surface in every vampire story, but like you can't make a vampire story. You can't make a good vampire story without those themes. Like mm-hmm. you can try and like wipe the slate clean as much as you want, but it's going to leave like a smear.
Mm-hmm.
If you try and paint over that, that's going to have like the brown under it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is like they are a fictional stand-in of a person that causes harm
mm-hmm.
and they will always be a person that causes harm. Like the fact that they must exist off a human resource, like living blood,
mm-hmm.
it makes them what they are. And a story about a vampire is like, it has to engage with that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of vampire stories, they kind of make them like landlords as like, oh, the taxes, it's like metaphorical for like excessive taxes
right.
and stuff like that. Which is also like, I think that's a very legitimate use of vampires in a story, but, Eureka does, you mentioned it kind of turns that on its head. Where they are perhaps a bit more like a disabled person.
Yeah.
Far more sympathetic characters.
Disability,
yeah.
Which can be very, very inconvenient and potentially draining to those around me and those I care about. And I can't always give back as much as I take.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that a lot of people are like that. And I think that those people, a lot of people are like that way more than I am.
Mm-hmm.
There's people that just like plain literally can't do anything for anyone. There's people that are like stuck in bed because their arms and legs are completely. There's people that are paralyzed from the neck down.
Well,
they can't do much for anybody. But they still, and it takes a lot of like people still have to give them food.
Mm-hmm.
They still eat food. They still take up electricity to keep their machines on and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain type of person that would say like, oh, you know, why don't we just let them die?
Yeah.
And the reason is because they're a human being and they are inherently valuable. And like they are contributing something by existing.
Right.
At the very least.
Yeah. And that contribution is personal to the people around them. Like I can, from my own experience, that I can agree with that statement of care and compassion for someone who cannot, and not out of pure will. Like they're not choosing to be in that state,
right?
And as much as others, in often who have no contact with it, believe that, in as you stated, and that weight that goes on that individual who's in that state is immense, trying to make decisions day to day. And that adds a whole nother weight to the story itself within that this game is slain. As I put it, you pen yourself as an investigative story, but what you're investigating is truly who these investigators are within the moment.
Yes. Human nature.
It's very, very character driven, and it is very much about the protagonists, the characters.
Yeah.
As much as it is about, in fact, in the current game we're doing in the book club, the scary haunted house has taken an almost complete backseat to a like dramatic implosion of the party.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it to the sense that like Shadowrun is a story about runners who need money or something. And really it is the motions that they go through are just that. It's almost gray background to who they are, but your game takes it to a whole new level. Like the investigation is just the backdrop almost to the discovery of how they feel about the events that are occurring, how these investigators are accepting, not accepting, examining the world that exists around this investigation and what's happening. And looking at it through that lens makes it much easier to see all of the components that go into that, that go into making those events feel real and visceral and like, to every step that the investigators take.
And this composure is super important.
Yeah.
And like, I guess I'm kind of reiterating, but like this, I think it's very important that it's not just a thing on a vampire character's character sheet that's like, oh, this character must drink blood.
Mm-hmm.
Do it once per session, they drink blood. Like this is part of the like difference between Powered by the Apocalypse and Eureka, is that in a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse games, that's how that it would be done.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
this character gets a piece of experience points when they drink blood. As like there's nothing, they are treated as like they're intrigued, like they woke up one day and they decided to be a blood drinker.
Yeah.
Whereas the way that the composure system like grinds down a character's ability mm-hmm. to do what they need to do, and like it affects their emotional state, it everything. Like they, you as the player, and like you as the player are seeing this character. This character's descent towards the moment where they are going to sneak behind some guy walking home from the bar and drag him behind a dumpster and drink their blood
mm-hmm.
rather than just like being born evil.
Right.
Like you are seeing the, how they got there.
Yes. The manifestation. How they got there. Yeah.
In a very, potentially very sympathetic light.
Mm-hmm.
And one other thing, because it doesn't necessarily work. It works very well for physical disabilities. Is like, I guess it's a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually despite being an author, I am constantly confusing the words or the definitions for metaphor and analogy, but it can work for like a physical disability, like somebody who has to be taken care of and like they take a lot of money, time, and energy of their caretakers and they can't help that.
Right.
And you know, maybe they feel bad about it. Maybe they don't feel bad about it. And Eureka does not say they should feel bad about it or they're going to hell.
Right.
Maybe they don't feel bad about it. Maybe they are. Oh, I'm getting off topic, but
no.
But
the point is that it leaves that agency.
Yes.
To let the story.
They may
occur.
Or may not feel bad about it.
Right.
But it can also work for mental disability,
mm-hmm.
Mental illness, and mental illness is a disability. When I was writing the composure mechanics and how they interact with monsters, there was a period of time where I was unsure whether or not they would be able to regain composure points from a comfort check of another investigator, because that's another way
mm-hmm.
to restore composure, and it's something that tends to build bonds between the characters and the party. You talked about that in your episode, Desserts in Storytelling,
mm-hmm.
like bonds between the PCs is good.
Mm-hmm.
And investigators can restore each other's composure by using the comfort skill mm-hmm. on each other. And it's not just like, rolling composure, two composure points, rolling comfort, two composure points back. And it has to be a little, there has to be dialogue there. That's a rule.
Right.
At the very least, give him a hug.
Right.
But, I was like, should monsters, because for monsters, composure is very much more of a like thing that is, it is very much more like a thing for their fuel mm-hmm. and that fuel being like the victims. It's like, so should they be able to mechanically get composure points back from comfort checks of other investigators? And I eventually landed on yes. Like, yes, that like even a vampire can get composure points back from a comfort check on their character. And I think that is, like, having support structures, having friends, that means that having friends can make a monster less likely to cause harm.
Right.
And just like in real life, where having friends and support structures and like a comforting environment rather than like a constantly stressful environment with where nobody's there for them is very likely to result in like somebody, for example, somebody who maybe is like severely mentally ill, that will prevent them from causing needless harm, and the emphasis on like needless harm to themselves or others, just in every case you'll ever look up.
Mm-hmm.
of people with severe mental illness, like people who have like a good parents and good support structures do not typically grow up to be serial killers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
And like in that way that can mirror Eureka can mirror by the way of monsters having to eat people a lot less if they have plenty of comfort checks coming from their party. I forgot how I was going to end that sentence, but I think you get the point.
Right. No. Absolutely. I mean, from personal experience, members of like the transgender community have a very high rate of self-harm, but like if you have at least one loving parent, that goes down to like single digit percentage.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a very good,
yeah.
Or the exact opposite when it's not there.
Right. Yeah. No.
It's removed.
It's astronomical. It's like 50%. Yeah. Right. So, or they're plus or minus a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I trust me, I absolutely understand what you're trying to say there. We are running very, very late, so do you want to kind of like start getting into wrapping up here? Do you guys have any sort of closing thoughts about this? Do you think this is a good game for new narrators to try out as their first game, or would you recommend that potential narrators for Eureka would get their feet wet, I suppose, with other games first and then roll into something like this? Is this more of an advanced mechanic sort of game?
Well, so I think it depends on the person, right? Mm-hmm. So Heatsink said in the live chat that, you know, the way Eureka approaches these problems is not for everyone, and I agree.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, it's not everyone's cup of tea, but if you like your tea bitter, mm-hmm. I think Eureka delivers.
I think that was a great way of saying it.
We were talking the other day during the mic test how Eureka can get pretty heavy and intense.
Oh, yeah.
Like, referring, I'm going to only spend like a couple sentences on this, referring back to how there's definitely a viewpoint that the person who can only take and never give back
mm-hmm.
should be removed from society.
Mm-hmm.
One way or another, like in the adventure that we're currently doing, where the party has completely freaking exploded or imploded and like all turn on each other, one of the characters has told Yvette the vampire that she needs to kill herself. Like, that's the only right thing to do. She cannot keep living a life where every week she murks somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't kill someone every week, but like, you know,
it's heavy.
Yeah,
it's real heavy. Yeah.
And that's not going to be a good fit for everyone, especially like for entering into the hobby.
Yeah.
But if that is the way that they like to approach that, if the genre is appealing, if the way it handles things is appealing, from a mechanical standpoint, yeah, I do think it's a good first choice. I think it gives good advice on how to be a narrator. I think that Eureka's gameplay equips a narrator well to handle other types of games, because it handles, you know, it handles a wide variety of circumstances.
Yep.
The fifth edition DMG just straight up does not teach you how to be a dungeon master. It teaches you the rules that a dungeon master needs to know.
Right.
But it does not teach you, like,
technique.
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of tricks and advice that you get that from, like, Reddit and YouTube videos.
And a podcast and or two.
Yeah, just a few podcasts.
Yeah.
just a few.
Like,
which, I guess I will then lead into the next question, which is something we often ask at the end of all of our system spotlights. What do you feel Eureka does well? In what it's trying to be, maybe even.
My answer is rewind to the beginning of the podcast.
That is fair.
Okay, fair enough.
It does investigation well.
Mm-hmm. I think it does very well.
Other mechanics are in service of doing investigation well, such as, like I mentioned, the serious combat, the serious nature of combat in Eureka, and how seriously it takes combat, is in service of the investigation, because it means that the party cannot just blow through their obstacles. They have to investigate. They have to search for the answer of how they're going to do this without getting their heads blown off.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's all the mechanics are in service to lean to a specific direction. And I think investigation is the right direction that all leans into and feels.
I would say it's a finely honed tool for doing investigation, but with an ear towards being very simulationist and grounded in what we understand to be reality.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I would agree.
It doesn't have a pulpy style or super heroic style or anything like that. It's very, very human.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like,
yes,
it also, I would say it also does monsters very well.
Yes.
In ways that I have basically never seen before. Vampire the Masquerade, it's like, it's all about vampires. It does have like deep and complex rules for vampires, and it does like occasionally hit on some very good themes.
Right. It doesn't do a very good job at motivation.
Yeah, Vampire had a stat called humanity on the thing, and this system humanizes the vampires far more than I think in theme and in practice than Vampire the Masquerade, which wrote humanity on your character sheet, ever did.
Yeah, I dare say that Vampire the Masquerade was like a Band-Aid on a wound that you talked about, whereas this game like rips the Band-Aid off and exposes it and says, that's a wound.
Mm-hmm.
Given that you two are longtime VTM players, or at least I think Rob is, I'd say that's high praise.
Yeah.
Thank you. Like, seriously. And, it's also something that you absolutely would never get from Vampire the Masquerade, at least my understanding, is that you would never have a situation where one PC in a party is a vampire and the rest are not.
It's pretty rare.
Yeah, we tried that once. You realize really quickly that the game systems are not balanced around each other.
No.
Yeah.
Which is a whole nother level of discussion about balance in this game.
Which I think is good. We're not going to get into that.
Yeah. I will ask this because I know it's hard to do self-examination. What do you think Eureka doesn't do well?
And keeping in mind that this question is oftentimes directed to, like, a hammer is not great for pulling screws out of a board.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I think it's an important question to ask, because it is a focus system. I don't think it does heroic stories very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we wouldn't want someone to buy Eureka thinking it's one thing, and then it totally isn't that, and then they leave us a terrible review.
Right.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. Eureka is a very mundane game. I don't think that it is good for heroic stories, larger than life characters. I don't think that it is good for other genres outside of like neo-noir, mystery, horror. I wouldn't use it for swashbuckling on the high seas. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't use it for like a gonzo comedy game.
No.
Bought Eureka, and worst dungeon crawl ever, 0 of 10.
Exactly. Terrible dungeon crawl. I think it works well with very active characters.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that is maybe potentially intimidating
for proactive people
who like
players.
To take a passive role, or you know, who like to make more passive characters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Eureka works well with that. And I also think that it does not work well with super long-term games. It's pretty focused.
Mm-hmm.
Once adventures to stay, you know, 2 to 8 sessions is a really sweet spot. Anything in excess of like 20, 25 sessions, you know, year-long campaigns, it's just not really suited to, partially because there is no advancement, which is meant to like encourage that kind of length of game.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I dare say, if I can, that this game is not for the faint of heart. If you cannot, and I see this all the time, that there's a lot of players who can't distance themselves from what their character is doing. They feel invested and involved, and when things don't go right, I mean, how many times have we seen I lost my +4 Holy Avenger, at, you know, the DM got rid of it, and I'm angry. Why?
Yeah.
Why do you as a player have that much investment in that thing? You know, well, I got it, you know, your character got it 16 sessions ago. Okay? So they're upset. What is your character going to do about that? No, I'm angry. Yeah. I'm going to have a conversation. No, the DM didn't do it to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a story. Play it, and if that separation isn't there, especially if you've got, you know, two investigators who are dealing with a lot of depth, like you were saying, and having some relatively deep conversations between them, that's beautiful. But if you can't have that separation, it's going to be harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't play Eureka if that is a difficult thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of, like, you know, I lost the +4 Holy Avenger, like, what's the best Star Wars movie? It's the one where Luke gets his hand cut off and loses his lightsaber, and the rebels lose.
Yeah, it's 2 hours of the rebels getting their asses kicked, and then the credits roll.
Right,
best movie ever.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I don't really like the Disney Star Wars movies.
Let's not look like Rogue Star Wars though. Too much.
But Rogue One is also one where the rebels they win ultimately, but it's a
costly
victory.
All right. I'm going to say this in our wrap up here. We have a few questions, but I'm kind of looking at these really quickly just to see if there's things about these as that we. I'm sure some of these we've already answered, but
I've taken up a lot of your time. I really appreciate your patience.
Oh no, and if you would. And I know we started talking about this, we were trying to say this, but I think if you could take some time with the Discord and answer some of these questions for our Discord members, I would truly appreciate it. And we can help post these. That would be, I think, really, really huge. A lot of these, I would say, in scope, we've answered through the show, but I want to give you guys a chance to talk about the Kickstarter. If you could refresh and see where you guys are at right now, I for some reason it's not coming up on mine. But is there anything in particular you guys want to expose or talk about with the Kickstarter, or give you a little moment here to market, if you will, while you're looking that up?
We are we're at 185%. We haven't gone up that much in the last like 2 hours.
Okay. Well, congratulations.
Well, you're still on day one.
Oh,
so.
Darn.
Yeah.
Fully funded day one is a great feat to have.
Mm-hmm.
It is huge.
Yes. I think it, like, I've heard that like that puts you on the front page and gets you a lot more attention.
Yep. Yeah, it's a.
Well, I'll look into that like tomorrow when I clock into Anium.
Yeah. Either way, I hope you both get amazing rest tonight, knowing where you're at.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
I've also very much enjoyed just hanging out in this on this episode.
It's been very fun.
If you'd ever want us to want to have us on again, we'll be making other games.
Fair enough, fair enough. Unfortunately, clock is kind of ticking on that one.
Yeah, so. we'll see how things end up here. But we appreciate both of you joining us on the show today and having this extended conversation. I know our listeners were interested to see where things are going with this, and we're so happy that your Kickstarter has gone so well. I don't have anything else for them. I know we've got to close up here in a second. Did you want to say anything?
I just want to thank you guys for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here to be able to talk about your own game system, and share your enthusiasm for it. So thank you very much for joining us, Addison and Ash.
Yeah, and please keep up the work effort. I know how hard it is to finally polish and finish things off. You've got a long road ahead of you, but we wish you both exceptional luck.
It just helps that knuckles.
Excellent.
All right, so next week's topic, we're going to be talking about table lingo, and this is the language that we use in our games. And this is kind of both from an in-character and out-of-character standpoint. We toss around words like Thaco and Benny and stuff like that, you know, and that's a weight that your players need to bear to learn those sort of lingos. But then you start getting into, you know, cyberpunk games where, you know, your Netrunner is sporting Preem cyberware, you know.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, hold on.
Or you have to get to the stuffer shack. Right, to, you know.
We're slicing the Gibson tonight, guys.
Exactly.
Okay, what? Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, how to make it accessible, how to make it fun, and use it in a way that's positive and immersive in your at your table. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at @ST_Conclave, on Instagram at @ST_Conclave. Listen to us live every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on mixlr.com/storyteller-conclave. And join us up on our Discord. Both Addison and Ash are up there. If you have questions about the show, about Eureka, et cetera, they'll be there answering questions. You can find that link on our Twitter as well as our website, storytellerconclave.com.
We'd like to thank our Patreon members who help us out every single month, especially our name members, Knox in the Box, Subjet, The Arcane Asylum, Veteran, Hulavu, Sam, Sean, and Sparkle Motion. We appreciate all your support. Our pre-show music is by Arcane Anthems. You can find them Instagram.com or Patreon.com as Arcane Anthems. Our intro music is Beyond the Warriors by Geefrog. You can find them at geefrog.bandcamp.com or on YouTube Music. And our outro music, which you're hearing right now, is Only Our Footprints in the Sand by Midair Machine. You can find them at freemusicarchive.org.
And big shout out to our families, Vicky and Sean. Thank you so much for loving and supporting us. All of our friends who sat with Set of Tables give these great stories to share with you over the years. Addison and Ash, one big shout out to you as well, to the Anim team, and you, every single one of our listeners. We love you guys so much.
Love you guys.
Good night.
Good night.